Final hour, Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. We are live from our Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Ian Safar here with you on this Wednesday morning. It is day number 3 of SEC Media Days. Our SEC Media Days coverage brought to you by Brewhouse South. Experience Nashville's ultimate sports and brew hangout at Brewhouse South in Cool Springs. As the week has gone on, you can feel the FOMO increasing with Joe Rexro for not being there down there at SEC Media Days.
I tell you what, man.
It's gotten worse every day.
I know. It's been tough. Thinking about Hugh Freeze, you know, going up there and having an opportunity to be a human being with a sense of humor and just, you know, completely dousing everything. I mean, Lane.
I was really hoping Hugh Freeze walk out there on stage with like a 6-iron yesterday. Yeah. Didn't happen.
Dressed up as Payne Stewart.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, you know, yep. Missed opportunity.
A caddy, maybe.
Tally-ho!
Yeah. Just walking out there. Guys, pay no attention to him. He's just my caddy. We're getting out of here pretty quick after the podium session's
over. We're cutting this short.
Yeah. My wife's already on hole 7, so by the time we're out of here, she might have made the corner, and she's at 11 right now. So,
what if Hugh Freeze,
we're going to have a few holes.
What if Hugh Freeze would have run into who's the former hockey player who beat the crap out of that dude last week?
Or Nick Tarnaski?
Yeah, Nick Tarnaski.
Yeah.
Hugh Freeze. You know, what if Hugh Freeze is playing a little slow out there?
I would hope Nick that Tarnaski. If Hugh Freeze.
I thought you were going to say Happy Gilmore.
Yeah. If Hugh Freeze got thrown into a pond to begin a fight, I'd hope he'd have enough sense to stop after that. Yeah. Unlike that other guy.
That guy, man. That guy kept coming. If anybody has not seen that yet,
look up Nick Tarnaski golf fight. You will not be disappointed.
I mean, and that guy just keeps coming back for more.
Yeah.
And then he just keeps getting pummeled.
Bang! Bang!
He's like saying it, right?
Bang!
He's like saying it as he punches his face.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome.
And then he just throws him to the side.
Like a rag doll.
Yeah, we would not want
former Pred,
that.
Nick Tarnaski, by the way.
There you go.
Played 11 games for
Fred's,
the Predators.
Fred's legend.
We
would assist. We would not want that to happen to Hugh Freeze.
No, we would not.
But we would like Hugh Freeze to have a sense of humor.
Josh Heupel.
Also not have a crappy team anymore, but we'll see about that.
He seems to think he's
he
not
He says
going
they're in the playoff discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they are right now.
That is true.
They're lost yet, so we'll see what happens on that front. Josh Heupel hopes his team is back in the playoff discussion this year. After an eventful offseason that included the loss of their quarterback, Heupel and the Tennessee contingent addressing the media yesterday. Heupel hopped on with Chase and Big Joe down in Atlanta. Talked about a lot of different things. As expected, Joe, like I knew when he got up here on that stage yesterday and throughout the whole process with the media that he was never going to come close to naming a starting quarterback. And look, I don't not believe him. Like, he probably doesn't know who his starting quarterback is going to be right now.
Absolutely.
Like, it's hard to be totally confident that, oh, yeah, Joey Aguilar is going to come in. It's all going to be fine. He's going to be ready to go. He's going to grasp the offense immediately, and we're all good from there. So I'm sure the competition is real, and we'll see how that ends up playing out. And the one thing I did get from Tennessee yesterday, and we heard it from Miles Kitzelman, and he started talking about how, yeah, you're going to look up and you're going to find Tennessee at 7-0 at one point this year, and you're going to be like, huh, how have they done this? I sensed a little bit of irritation from the Tennessee contingent yesterday in terms of how most people think that they're going like 7-5 or 8-4, and they're not including them in the college football playoff discussion. And Josh Heupel was asked by Chase yesterday if he feels like this year the Vols and him are getting a pass as it relates to the aftermath of all the Nico stuff. And here's what Josh Heupel had to say.
Man, it's been a long time since I walked into a ball game not thinking that we were going to win that ball game. It's been a long time, long before I got to Tennessee. Nobody in our program has ever used anything as an excuse from day one when we got there. When I got there, said we're good enough to win right now. Now, your margins might be different, you know, year to year, team to team. Your margins can be different, but this football team is good enough to go win. And, you know, that's the athletic traits that we have, both sides of the football. It's what we have in our staff room. We got to go compete and go take it every play, every practice, every day. And ultimately you get to kick off and, you know, coaches and players together got to find a way to go win the game.
So what do you make of that from Heupel and the – for lack of a better term, a mindset of Tennessee heading into this year, with most people looking at him and saying, yeah, you know, 7-4 or 7-5, 8-4, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Well, I want to know when he says long before I got to Tennessee. Does that include like when he was OC at Missouri and they lose? Actually, I think didn't they lose like 50 to something to Tennessee in one of those games? Like
it's a shootout. Yeah,
I thought that was a complete blowout. Am I wrong about that?
I'd have to go back and look.
But yeah, so you got the coach speak there of like we plan to win every game and we never think we're going to lose and all that stuff, right? So there's that part of it. But I think he's going to with his team. I think he's going to absolutely use this. Why not? Take advantage of it. You know, because of the success he's had, they haven't been able to really do much of that, right? It's like, can you build off? You know, obviously, disappointment, you don't make the playoff in Hendon Hooker's year, and he gets hurt, and Connor Stallions gives him all your players, or whatever happened that year. But then you have, you know, the expectations have been high. They've been high for Nico and all that stuff. So it's been really since his first year that he's had a chance to be like, because, I mean, I think even going into his second year after the very pleasantly surprising first year, expectations were pretty high.
Well, right? you knew Hooker was going to be really good.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So he'll lean into it, and I think he's not surprised by any of these questions at all, you know. And he knows the situation. And if he's being honest, like at home, he probably does. Like, if you're allowing yourself as a coach to look at hypotheticals that include losing games, that people do have a little bit of grace for him based on the Nico situation.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how it all plays out. Like the quarterback part of it for sure, because I think regardless of how good or bad the quarterback play is this year, it's easy to look at it and say, well, if Jake Merklinger is the starter this year or if Joey Aguilar is the starter this year and it doesn't go particularly well, it's like, well, you got George McIntyre already in the program. At the moment, you've got Faison Brandon coming in, and you're feeling good about the future, hopefully with at least one of those guys that sticks around and is a good player, right? So you're feeling good about that if you're Tennessee. I think this is a really important year from Heupel from everything else beyond quarterback. What does the offensive line look like this year? How good are the wide receivers this year? I'm not saying they've got to be elite, but I think you need to feel pretty good about the direction with a lot of your young guys surrounding the quarterback this year. That needs to be something you walk away with this year. I'm not saying that Tennessee has to make the playoff, because right now, if I had to pick, I would assume they're not. Like I think they're probably an 8-4-ish team this year. So you're not getting in the playoff at 8-4. But I look at their wide receivers, their offensive line in particular, and do they have some building blocks that you look at the end of the year and say, yeah, those guys are really good. And if you figure out quarterback heading into next year, that you got a chance to be back in there competing again. I don't know. Like, Heupel would hear something like that and be like, you're crazy. We're trying to make the college football playoff this year. And I get it. Maybe they will. I don't know. But there's a lot of question marks they've got hitting on the team. I think quarterback is less important for them this year. I think everything offensively around the quarterback, we're going to find out a lot about what they're building this year.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's like at this point in your program, the Nico thing's a setback. It's an unforeseen situation. Well, I don't know if it's totally unforeseen because when they were recruiting him, there were people. They're like, boy, Nico's dad. Just be ready. But still, yep. I mean, that's reality QB, but still, you didn't expect things to go down the way they did. But everything else, this has a matured program now. So, yeah, to Brandon's daily point, offensive line, Glenn Ellerbe, you know, that's a big deal. We were talking earlier about them running the ball. I mean, I do think the offense lends itself to that. I think it helps with that. But, you know, the pass protection, the whole thing, the whole picture, it just hasn't been – I mean, that's the same thing that has not been at the level it needs to be since that 2022 season.
The other part of this is their schedule, because it's not necessarily an overly daunting schedule. Now, it's got Georgia in there and Alabama and Florida, and those are probably, if I had to guess, the three teams as of right now that they would be picked to lose against, right? Like, if you're setting Vegas lines, and, you know, you can't find them for every game right now, but I know that they're a double-digit favorite against Syracuse, even with their quarterback situation. Georgia, they will be an underdog at home. Alabama, I think I found that line last week, and they were like a double-digit underdog to Alabama on the road. You know, Florida, they'll probably be an underdog on the road. Other than that, it's probably toss-up at worst. Like at home against Oklahoma, I think that's got a chance to be a tough game for them. But I would imagine, as we sit here today, they're probably toss-up or slightly favored in that game because it's at home. Kentucky, how good are they going to be this year? Arkansas, they beat Tennessee last year, but that one's at home at Neyland. Mississippi State on the road, like Mississippi State, I don't think it's very good. So their schedule sets up where they've got a chance, unless their quarterback play is just awful. They've got a chance still. I mean, you're talking about a team that's going to be favored in all but three of their games, I think.
Yeah, so if they do, yeah, just get decent QB play. Everything else is, you know, decent, not a worst case scenario with the O line. I think the defense will be good. The receivers, you know, you're able to have some guys produce. Yeah, the 9-3 is right there on the table. And if 9-3 is on the table, if the lines tell you that 9-3 is what they're supposed to be, well, 9-3 is fringe playoff team now. If you lose those three games, what are the nine wins? What of those nine wins are super valuable?
I mean, unless
you never know.
Unless Oklahoma gets a really good year at quarterback from Mateer coming in, which could happen, by the way.
Yeah. So hey, look, Vanderbilt could be a decent win.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know, but based on what we think of these teams, they'd probably be just on the outside looking in. But if that's the case, if you go 9-3 and you just miss out on the playoff, I think that's 100% a pass.
Yeah, I would agree. To me, there's no scenario. Like, I look at pass and people talking about getting a pass. Like, is Josh Heupel's job going to be on the line at the end of this year? It's hard for me to get.
It's more like the discussion, right?
The discussion.
It's more like the fans. Like, are they gonna get to the point where we know with Tennessee fans, it's like they love a coach, to defend him to the death, and all of a sudden want to kill him.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that we're going to get to that this year. I will say, though, like if they're 8-4 this year after making the college football playoff last year, then next year becomes crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Like it becomes very big for him in the larger discussion of it.
Which is potentially tough just because, like, if Merklinger is not very good or McIntyre's not ready or whatever, you know, then maybe they're casting their lot with Brandon.
As a true freshman.
But it's like, well, you got to give him another year. You know, so on and on it goes. There's a thought here that I'd like to refute.
Too.
Same thing?
Yep. Okay. We'll get into that coming up next. 615-737-1025, our phone number. Robbie and Rex Road, 1025-1063, the game. Welcome back in. Robbie and Rex Road, 1025-1063, the game. Taking your thoughts on our phone and text lines driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. Talking Vols, taking your thoughts on our phone and text lines driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Joey, a text you would like to respond to.
So this is – so Chris in Nashville says, I'm a Vol fan, but Heupel should have had a QB ready. Nico could have gotten hurt and lost in the first game of the season. My response was, that's college football today for all coaches. It's – look, even really, if you want to go back before all this stuff, quarterback rooms, and you follow any college football program closely, I mean, the third QB often – would bail out of there anyway. Now it's the second, though,
yep.
Which is the problem. He responds, right, Florida and Ole Miss had backup that seemed ready. I honestly don't remember how Ole Miss's backup performed last year.
I think it was Austin Simmons.
Okay. Florida's was DJ Lagway, who was a five-star freshman who obviously is – so sometimes you can time it out where it's like, yes, I'm coming as a freshman and I know I'm the future and I'm there, and he's obviously good, so good for them. So I don't know if Faison Brandon is going to be that level of QB. You know, if he was there last year, then it'd be this similar situation. Also, as you pointed out in the break, Robbie, we don't know that Heupel doesn't have a QB ready.
Merklinger might be good.
Merklinger was a four-star recruit who had, I don't remember all the offers, but he had really good offers along with Tennessee, you know, and he's the guy. I mean, that's what you do. You recruit the next guy, and we have no idea if he's good or bad. We have no idea if he's great or terrible. So I don't understand the complaint, but that's where you get into. I mean, if you think that everybody has like a Nico and then just has another Nico, that's just not living in reality.
I mean, he was offered by Merklinger, Auburn, Arkansas, Boston College. I mean, I can go down the list. Or you just listen to this in alphabetical order. But
so he's not the level of recruit that Nico was or that Faison Brandon was, but like a good, legit SEC quarterback. And who, and you know, as we know with recruiting rankings,
yeah,
in bulk they mean something, but Merklinger, individually,
he was offered by Florida and Georgia. Like he's good prospect. Now he's not a five star guy. Like it's not like he's the number one recruit in America, but that's not the only quarterbacks that get offered high level SEC programs.
There's going to be a Georgia fan who immediately jumps all over you for saying he was offered by Georgia. Because it'll be like, it wasn't a committable offer.
I mean, he was offered by Georgia. I have no idea.
Yeah. You know, but that's how, you know.
I'm rolling down the list of offers here. He's offered by Georgia. I have no idea what to tell you. He's offered by Miami, too. So, again, you can take all that for what you want. But
regardless, yeah. So, that's the guy. They had him as a backup, and we'll see. We'll see. Obviously, you have to go out and try to get someone when Nico leaves. They did. And that's where I get into just the presumption that a lot of people have. Although, there was some talk this week from yesterday about him trying to do the leadership thing and having people. And it's like, okay, that's good. You want that. But I still don't take that as any kind of confirmation that he's going to be the starting quarterback. I'm sticking with Merklinger as the starter in the opener. We'll see.
There's an interesting piece at the Tennessean from our buddy Gentry Estes, and it kind of talks about how, you know, if you look at the human expectations for Tennessee this year, they're not very high, but the analytics love them. Like, so he talks about the USA Today poll and the predictions for the SEC. They've got Tennessee 10th in the SEC, 10th out of 16. And I think Athlon has them at number 10 as well. And the top 25 from The Athletic after the spring had him at number 13 with Nico as the quarterback. And then with Nico gone, they took him out. So not even in the top 25. And then you look at the analytics, and as Gentry points out in his piece, you know, analytics have Tennessee a 39% chance to return to the college football playoff, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's pretty high. Like, I mean, it's the fourth best in the SEC behind Texas, Georgia, and Alabama. So you've got, like, the human expectations telling you one thing and the analytics telling you another. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with the schedule that we just talked about, and it's not, you know, an overly challenging schedule for Tennessee.
Yeah. So that's when you say analytics, is that like ESPN, FBI?
ESPN analytics.
Or
All-State playoff.
And that is a big part of that is – just like your roster talent, you know, like your star level, things like that, the roster. And that's the thing. I mean, Tennessee has recruited well. They haven't recruited at the top, like we were just talking about the other day, the top shelf, but they've recruited well. Yeah. They have a lot of good, talented young players, some of whom we're going to learn this year. And we'll say their names. I know that may be controversial to, you know, talk about specific individuals on a sports team, on a sports talk show. But That's I think where that comes from, you know, the overall talent. Now, again, does that play itself out with the offensive line? I think the thinness of the receiving corps, some of these nuances miss those analytics. So you take it all with a grain of salt, including everything we say.
I got one text that says, no love from the young man from Brentwood, talking about George McIntyre. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, true freshman, you know, if he's – I tell you what, if he really – hangs in there, and it's one of those things where like they have to keep giving him reps well into camp. Well, I mean
if that's the case, then you could make the argument to just go ahead and go with it. Like if he makes it that close with the other two in camp, you could make the argument to just go ahead and go and see what he thinks. I'm not going to totally discount it. And Hypo got up there yesterday. And he was talking about the quarterback competition, and he made sure every time he was asked about it, talk about all three of them. So he's not on the surface counting George McIntyre out of it either. To me, it's hard to see a true freshman coming in to that offense and playing. You know, Nico, as highly recruited as he was, came in and did not start his first year. So I think it's always worth remembering on that front.
Exactly. Now, different guy. I mean, we are talking coach's son.
We are.
And sometimes that can maybe accelerate the process of things like that. So different people have a different learning curve and all that. I think there's some excitement about him. You know, it's And that's where it could get really interesting too. Like, even again, look ahead to next year. Like, if McIntyre is clearly better than Merklinger, or he's right there neck and neck, if you're leaving, you know, so then you can get into what a competition that could be, or even, gosh, do you do a 2QB thing? Who knows? That doesn't seem to be a big hypo thing. But, look, they have possible answers at least, you know. And even this year, if you told me all three of those guys would end up starting a game just because of the reality of injuries, and I wouldn't be that surprised.
615-737-1025, our phone number, 615-737-1025. There is a feud that is ongoing between two, at one time, very prominent members of the NFL that is pretty hilarious. We'll get back into that coming up next. Robbie and Rex Road, 1025, 1063, The Game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road, 1025, 1063, The Game. Got some tickets to give away to Holiday World and Splash and Safari in Santa Claus, Indiana. Be caller 3. 615-737-1025. Caller 3 will win a pair of tickets to Holiday World and Splash and Safari coming up in Santa Claus, Indiana. We're taking your thoughts on our phone and text lines driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. 615-737-1025. Joe, a feud in the NFL, not a food, a feud, that has been, I guess, reignited would be the right word here. So Robert Kraft had some comments a little while ago talking about Bill Belichick, and basically said that it was a, quote, big risk to hire him back in 1999. I think this is what the full quote was, quote, "I gave up a number one draft pick for a coach that had only won a little over 40% of his games to get him out. I don't know if there are any Jets fans here. I think getting Bill Belichick to come to the Patriots in 99 was a big risk, and I got hammered in the Boston area. But he was with us for 24 years," is what Robert Kraft had to say. So I guess Bill Belichick came out yesterday, and the comments came out where he's taking a shot back at Robert Kraft.
Yeah, talking to Don Van Natta from ESPN, right, who is basically like one of his biographers.
This is the quote that Belichick had in Kraft's direction. Quote, "As I told Robert multiple times through the years, I took a big risk by taking the Patriots head coaching job. I had already had an opportunity to be the head coach of the New York Jets, but the ownership situation was unstable." He went on, quote, "I had been warned by multiple previous Patriots coaches, as well as other members of the NFL organizations and the media, that the New England job was going to come with many internal obstacles. I made it clear that we would have to change the way the team was managed to regain the previously attained success," is what Bill Belichick said.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
So were the obstacles, the many internal obstacles, are they all Robert Kraft getting in the way, meddling owner? What are we saying here? What are we saying?
Kind of sounds like that. Actually,
I've
told Robert many times that this place was an absolute dumpster fire before I got here, and I was the one that came in and fixed it.
The idea also that, like, people were advising him that, no, the Jets, that's actually the more stable situation.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the thing is, they had been to the Super Bowl. I mean, so they had Parcells. What were the years that Parcells was there? Parcells, I believe, I mean, I think Parcells was the coach when they got to the Super Bowl. Am I right?
Lost to the Packers? Yes, guiding them to the Super Bowl. He was there from 93 to 96.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, clearly, Belichick, for people who don't know, I mean, he's a Parcells disciple. He was his D coordinator with the New York Giants. Pretty good to be the D coordinator with the New York Giants when you have Lawrence Taylor and Harry Carson, et cetera, et cetera. But that's how he, you know, elevated. So obviously he's talking about Parcells, right? Like, I mean, I would assume Parcells would be one of the guys who talked to him. Parcells did have success there. So, I mean, you know, the Patriots have been, you have to go back. They actually were like, the Patriots were like the Browns, the Lions of the NFL, like in the early 90s, and Parcells really turned it around, and he got out of there. So I guess there's at least some, like, maybe validity to it, but the idea that there were all these people saying that the Jets would be the better option is pretty funny to think about right
it
now.
It is. It's also hilarious.
The whole thing is just funny.
That, like, with the amount of success that franchise had over Belichick's tenure there, that Belichick and Robert Kraft apparently just hate each other the way that they do. and maybe hate's a strong word, but they clearly just keep sniping back and forth at each other. And there are clearly some very hard feelings on Belichick's end from how things ended there in New England.
I honestly think, and maybe they were just putting up a front, but I honestly think it was a good relationship most of the time. And then when Brady left, won that Super Bowl, I just think Kraft probably reevaluated how he looked at the whole picture, right? Yeah. And probably fair to some extent, although I almost feel like we're getting to the point now, and maybe some of this is Belichick's whatever the hell he's doing right now out there. I think he's almost getting to the point. He might end up being underrated. Like a few years ago, it was clear. Like Bill Belichick is the greatest coach in NFL history. And like I think like all the things that have unfolded have stripped a lot of that away for a lot of people. And I think that Robert Kraft's one of them.
I agree.
You know, and he probably is a little too down on, but obviously Belichick is sensitive about that stuff. Yep. I mean, the fact that Belichick in his book, I'll go back to it, like, didn't mention him in his book. I mean, come on.
It's kind of crazy. Yeah.
Like, good, bad, indifferent, it's a huge part of, like, you're trying to tell your football story
and
you don't talk about the owner of the team you work for 20. I mean, come on. That's so petty and, like, I just said, I think that Belichick might be getting a little disrespected as a coach, but his pettiness and sensitivity have become very clear, too.
Well, and it's also – and I can't remember where this was because, frankly, there have been 1,000 documentaries and interviews and all these – and books that have come out about all this stuff, so I can't keep track of all the interviews that Robert Kraft and Bill Belichick are doing. But I do remember some comments from Kraft specifically talking about, like, the quarterback part and, like, basically he said that Belichick came up to him and said that Brady was done. Like, it's basically what he said. And then Brady went on to Tampa Bay – and played obviously great football for 3 years there in Tampa Bay, including a Super Bowl win.
And it seems so ridiculous now, but everybody thought that. Now I know it's still like, yeah, but everybody isn't the guy who's with him day after day. So everybody else can be wrong. He can't be wrong. But it looked that way. His last pass with the Patriots was a feeble little flip out that Logan Ryan ran back into the end zone. I was like, well, great career, Brady. Good for you. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what he did. He really got the plyometrics going after that.
Let the record show that we had a discussion that offseason about whether or not the Titans should sign Brady or re-sign Tannehill, and I said Brady. Let the record show. Let
Is
it show.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I did not.
I know.
Yeah. Well, I obviously right now you go back and say that's crazy, but I also saw Ryan Tannehill play
pretty well.
I mean, so that was – that was 2020, right? The next year, Tannehill goes 33 touchdowns, 5 picks.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Number 2 offense in the NFL, 31 points a game. But still, Brady won it all again. So what are you going to say? That's totally changed this relationship. I mean, the Brady roast was hilarious because, like, you could tell, you know, they were kind of able to joke around, but also, like, okay, this is a sore
pretty
spot.
Hard feeling.
Yeah,
there.
This is a sore spot.
Well, again, it's becoming – clear, and we knew this the whole time. Like, Brady was the key cog in that whole thing. It's always going to be that way with the player, right? Like, the player, especially the quarterback, is the most important part of a franchise winning all the time. Like, you know, Bill Walsh, great coach in San Francisco, right? And Bill Walsh, to his credit, won it with 2 different quarterbacks, right? I mean, you had Young and Montana, so he ended up with a couple of great quarterbacks. But everybody looks at Joe Montana and is like, man, Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, like those guys winning the Super Bowl, it's the players. So I get that. And it probably has gone a little bit too far the other way. Like, I think there are some people that think like Belichick is just a really average to below average coach and Brady has just elevated him. I don't think that, but I do think it's a reminder of, like, there's a limitation on coaching in the NFL. And a lot of it just comes down to how good your players and specifically how good your quarterback, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like people don't want to acknowledge this too, and I say it. And I'm a Brady hater, but you know, those early teams were. I think those were more Belichick stamp teams. They were great defenses. He did not put up video game numbers. He did not have to do ridiculous things. Throwing the ball, he was great. I mean, he came in, but I also think that I think that Drew Bledsoe could have won one of those Super Bowls. I do. And obviously he was a starter in Brady's plan. Does Brady end up being way better than him? Yes. So it worked out fortuitously for them, but those were Belichick teams, and he built that, and he knows how to build a – and I think the way that stuff they did with personnel, which has they've tried to replicate, and I think he obviously really fell off in that way, right, as a GM of the Patriots.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't good late, but, like, it was very good for a long time. It wasn't just Brady.
I will say, though, like, in terms of his legacy and the way that Belichick is going to be viewed here, I do think it's important for him to go to North Carolina and maybe not win a national championship, but, like, they need to be pretty good. Because if he goes there and it's like what Ryan McGee said last week, which he has, like, no confidence that Belichick's going to do anything.
They're just going to go 8-4 no matter what forever and ever.
Like, if he goes there and it's not very good, that's just another thing people are going to point to, and they're going to be like, well, look at his record before Brady. Look at his record at New England after Brady. And then look at him trying to build a program in North Carolina and it just totally falling on his face. Like, I think it's pretty important for him to go there and have some level of success at North Carolina.
Yeah, I agree. Head coach Bill Belichick, defensive coordinator Nick Saban, 8-8 with the Cleveland Browns.
I mean, I've heard some people say, I mean, look at Belichick. He's just like the ultimate example of luck in his career. He had Brady as his quarterback. And as he was coming up as a DC, he had Lawrence Taylor as his best player. It's like you end up with maybe the greatest defensive player of all time and the greatest offensive player of all time. That should help.
Right. Like you have those. They both have a claim as the best football player ever.
Yeah.
It does help as a coach. You get smarter.
It does. 615-737-1025. Our phone number, 615-737-1025. There was a trade that I speculated on last week, Joe, that may have some smoke to it this offseason. Ooh. We'll get into that coming up next. Robbie and Rex Road, 1025, 1063, the game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road, 1025, 1063, the game. Taking your thoughts on our phone and text lines driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, 615-737-1025. Joe, I brought up last week a potential situation to monitor in the NHL that if you're the Predators, I think you should have your eye on. And we talked about Mason McTavish with the Anaheim Ducks, who is a young centerman at the age of 22. He is a former number 3 overall pick. He has played on some bad Anaheim teams to this point and has already at the age of 22 compiled 229 games in his NHL career. Last year he put up 52 points, 22 goals, 30 assists in 76 games. And with the additions that Anaheim has made this offseason, there is some speculation that he could become frustrated with his role, and there's some speculation that whether it's via offer sheet or via trade package that some teams may try to acquire him this offseason. And I said, if that's the case, then that's something the Predators need to be monitoring very closely, because Mason McTavish at the age of 22, while I don't know that he is ever going to become like a true bona fide stud number one center, he would be a player that at that age and with the production that we've seen to this point and the size, a lot of things about him to like, and that I'd be interested in that if I'm the Predators. Well, some more information on that coming out yesterday, not necessarily directly related to the Predators, but Frank Saravalli, who is a longtime NHL reporter and knows his stuff, was discussing some of the latest buzz that he's hearing on the Mason McTavish front. Here's what Frank Saravalli had to say yesterday.
Any talk of Mason McTavish getting moved? He's one name to watch for me, I think, moving forward. I think it's been a tough go for McTavish in Anaheim. I view McTavish just from a, I don't know if mental standpoint, but body language standpoint is the right way to say it. I view him as sort of a bit of a depressed asset in the sense that I think a really solid player that has been beaten down by a lot of losses in Anaheim, that I view him as similar to Trevor Zegras. I think a change of scenery would be good for him. I think there's a lot of teams that are interested. I think some teams have tried to work on what an offer sheet might look like for Mason McTavish, as it seems like that's one of those situations that's going to be a struggle, much in the same way that getting that Zegras contract was for Anaheim. But no one can really put together something on paper that they think is going to dissuade Anaheim from turning down or not matching that offer sheet. Just because the Ducks have so much cap space, it's really hard to offer sheet a team that has a ton of space. So keep an eye on Mason McTavish, though. I think he's going to be an interesting name to watch moving forward.
So that was Frank Saravalli. He was talking a lot about the offer sheet part of it there. And to his point, like, I'm looking at puckpedia.com, and the Ducks have almost $29 million in cap space. So while they do have some guys coming up over the next couple of years here that they're going to have to sign to long-term deals, the cap is also going up, as we know, in the NHL. So I don't know that the offer sheet is going to be the way to go for McTavish. But I guess the question continues to be, does it deteriorate to the point where they end up just having to trade him? And, Joe, there continues to be smoke to this, and people keep talking about it. So it makes me think there has to be at least some conversations going on behind the scenes here.
Yeah, oh, no question. I think him talking about it that much right there is a tell for sure, you know. And if you're a Preds fan, boy, you hope that Barry Trotz is knee-deep in any conversation. Yeah. This not saying this like transforms the whole team, but man, would it be a big answer at the biggest question and fill such a hole and allow people to slot into actual reasonable places if somehow they're able to acquire him. I mean, he's good.
Yeah, he's a good player.
He's a good player. He's produced. As Frank said there, it's not easy when you're getting beaten down, losing year after year after year. I mean, someone asked Connor Bedard right now how much he's enjoying his time in the NHL so far. So, and I granted, if he were to come to Nashville, it's right now, it doesn't,
may not be
may
a lot
look
great.
But you could also look at Nashville as a player like him and say, okay, I'll take Stamkos on my wing. You know, I could see how this team could turn around. There's a lot of talent still.
Yeah, like if you're the Predators, I think it makes a lot of sense to explore this. Now, again, like the offer sheet part of it, I don't think you can go crazy with it either. And even if they made a trade and signed him to a long-term extension, like, you know, what's the dollar amount you're willing to go to with Mason McTavish, who, again, I think is a good player. I don't know that Mason McTavish is ever going to be like some 80-point guy or anything like that. So you have to keep that in the back of your mind. But I do think Mason McTavish could be a pretty good number two center in this league as his career goes on here. And the production at age 22 on, again, a bad team, 52 points in 76 games, that's not nothing. Like, it's a good player.
No.
So it's, again, something to keep your eye on this offseason if you're Barry Trotz. With a situation that does not have a lot of answers down the middle right now, and there's some even thought on that this year with Anaheim. Like, you know, they brought in Granlund. So are they playing Granlund on the wing, or are they playing him down the middle? If so, are they moving McTavish to the wing? Like, what is all that going to look like? There's a lot for them to figure out there, and I wonder if the Predators could be one of the teams that try to take advantage of that.
We spent so much time, like, talking about Trevor Zegras. I mean, we've probably talked about him. I mean, that's a hope player, you know, at this point. Like, this is a guy who has produced. So, no, I mean, look, you just hope that Barry Trotz is, and I'm sure he's in on it. I'm sure that he's looking at me. You know, they're going to say what they say, and you know what? Maybe Svechkov is ready and all that stuff, but, like, they know. They know that has to be addressed. If you want to, you know, maybe down the road it gets addressed with people coming up. But right now, if you want to be competitive next year, it's just hard for me to get there if they don't address it in some way.
So we will see what happens on that front, if anything, this offseason with Mason McTavish and whether or not the Predators can get involved in that discussion. Joe, that's going to do it for us today here on the program. Chase and Big Joe are going to catch up with David Cutcliffe later today and Greg Sankey at 12:45 coming up. So make sure you're tuned in for that. DVD's coming up next. You're listening to 102.5, 106.3, The Game.